Blog Talk Radio.
And here we are this week. The Injustice Department has asked for a delay in the ruling by a federal court that the don't ask, don't tell practice of the military be delayed immediately. A famous national toy store is offering to take trade-ins of old iPods for the sale of a new iPod or iPhone. They're offering up to $100 but may offer less. If I trade mine in, will I get less because of my taste in music? In Illinois, the Green Party candidate, who goes by the name, I'm sorry, let me try that again. The Green Party candidate is Richard Whitney. He goes by the name Rich. In what has to be considered one of the most unfortunate electoral misspellings ever, Illinois election officials misspelled his name on some of the voting machines to be used on November 2nd. They left off the N in his last name. About half of the machines will be in African-American precincts, and the correction can't be done before the election. So a lot of black voters are going to be invited to vote for a guy who's listed as Rich Whitey. Christine O'Donnell, the candidate who's nominally a Republican but is really running for the Senate as part of the Idiot Party, demonstrated why Sarah Palin supporters adore her. When asked in last night's televised debate to name any Supreme Court decision with which she disagreed, she promised to get back to the questioner or put up a case on her website. She couldn't think of one? Okay, I understand she might think the Dred Scott decision was wonderful, but she couldn't think of Brown versus Board of Education, which she probably does disagree with? A journal study has just been released that points out that there was much less cancer in ancient times than there are modernly. It concludes that it's because there was less pollution then, and people didn't smoke. Okay, and maybe it's because, due to poor sanitation and other reasons, people died of cholera at age 25 and 30, so they weren't around to get cancer at age 60. I hope to God we didn't fund that study. A group of state attorneys general are gearing up for an investigation of phony or illegal foreclosure procedures. This could actually and realistically be a multi-trillion dollar scandal, and we'll talk about it in a few minutes. Tonight, Senator Harry Reid of Nevada is set to debate wingnut Sharon Angle, as the election for senator is actually too close to call. One can only hope that the TV camera operates like a laser to show what Sharon Angle is really like. If it does, of course, the question is, are the people in Nevada really strange enough to elect her? In another strange race, Connecticut has a Republican, Linda McMahon, who is the CEO of the World Wrestling Enterprises, WWE. It used to be called WWF, for World Wrestling Federation. It's an organization that puts on fictitious fights that nevertheless result in the deaths of her employees. She's running against a Democrat who lied about fighting in Vietnam. Thankfully, he appears to be ahead. A battle is going on now between Cablevision, a major cable TV provider, and the Fox network over fees. Viewers of Cablevision may temporarily lose the broadcasts of the Fox network. And this would be a loss. Why? The price of oil futures is down despite slippage in the dollar, and a report that stockpiles are lower than first thought. This is a good news reaction to bad news. It could be good for you if you drive a car. And the University of Mississippi can't seem to get it right. Their old mascot was a white-bearded plantation owner-looking gentleman in a red suit, kind of looked like Colonel Sanders. It brought back images of the South's historic and perhaps the Tea Party's present racist viewpoints. So they decided to create a new mascot. It's a trousers and athletic shoe-wearing bear who also wears an Ole Miss jersey and is holding a flag with the university's name on it. Depending on how you look at it, the bear is either opening his mouth to talk or looks somewhat menacing. It is, of course, a black bear. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. All that, news of the weird, this week in history, and our guest, Jonathan Maxwell, to speak about his book called Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites, and the Nazi SS, along with other cheerful subjects. We'll also talk about modern anti-Semitism. We also have a special announcement tonight, so please stay with us. But first, we wanted to invite you to a site that will tell you some things about insurance. It's mostly for folks in Arizona from which we broadcast, but you might find it interesting anyway. The site is, and I know you're writing this down furiously, insuranceandmoreaz.blogspot.com. And you can take a look at that and find out about one of the other things I do, as well as find out about insurance more broadly. We have, as I mentioned, News of the Weird, This Week in History, and we also have an opportunity for you to join us, should you be interested in doing so, either before or during the conversation we have with Jonathan Maxwell. The phone number to call, if you'd like to do that, is 347 area code 994-3796. And if you want to be like the caller last week and ask me why liberals hate America, that's perfectly fine, too. Feel free to call. The announcement first, this is the second-to-last program in this series. By this series, I mean this program. There is a possibility that I may return at a future date. But after tonight, we will have one last show next week, and we do have a guest scheduled. But we are, frankly, stopping the show because of the fact that obviously it takes the hour to do while we're together, and it also takes some time to prepare and set aside time for the show and so forth. And frankly, the time has become a drain on what else I'm doing. So as much as I've enjoyed this, it will be time to shut down the microphone and the studio after next week until and unless we return. There is, again, that's a possibility for the future. We don't have any specific plans, but although they have been discussed. So join us tonight. Of course, you're already here, and next week. And if you're listening to us in archive edition, this show is being done live October 14th, and the next show, of course, will be October 21st, and if you want to join us for that, that's fine. We are assuming that the rest of the country hasn't changed to changed out of daylight saving time by next week. We will be on from 7:30 to 8:30 Pacific time, and as said, that will be the last show. In the meantime, let's talk about some of these stories. Let me mention the phone number again, 347-994-3796, but we'll go ahead and talk about some of these stories. We mentioned the Justice Department has asked the judge, the federal judge, who ruled that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is no longer any good and issued an injunction against the military enforcing it. They're asking her to delay the ruling by basically an injunction. Not an injunction, by a stay of the injunction, holding back of the injunction, so that the federal government has time to appeal. The Justice Department announced that they are going to probably appeal this decision because they have as part of their job that they defend all congressional laws. Don't Ask, Don't Tell started out as an executive order signed by Bill Clinton in 1993. Almost immediately thereafter, and frankly below the radar screen, nobody really noticed it at the time that I recall, Congress passed a law saying two things. Number one, that was now going to be the law, and that secondly, any change would have to be done by Congress. In effect, that is the reason that President Obama has said he cannot, like Bill Clinton did then, or Harry Truman did with regard to integration of the military. If I didn't say Harry Truman integrated the military, that's what I meant to say. They did that with a stroke of the pen. It was an executive order. There is a really, really good argument that the law that Congress passed limiting the president's right to do that is unconstitutional because the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. But apparently the president doesn't want to get involved in a constitutional battle through the courts. So he is saying that he would prefer that this be done through congressional action as opposed to court action, or even if he wanted to try it, executive action alone. So they are appealing it. I think it's a mistake, but that's obviously not a decision anyone's asked me to make. And you can tell us how you feel about that if you want. But, excuse me, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, everybody knows is going to go. It's really a question of how and when. And the reason that the Justice Department is asking for the delay, besides the fact that that's the normal logical thing to do when they're appealing, is because they're saying that by doing it that rapidly or that abruptly, it will disrupt order in the military. And there's a war going on, after all. Okay, end it. End it however you want to end it, but end it now. It's stupid. For one thing, it's not being practiced correctly. Although the military technically is not supposed to ask someone about their sexual practices, well, they're not supposed to ask someone if they're homosexual. They go ahead, and if someone rats somebody out, then the military does investigate and will, in fact, dismiss someone or discharge someone from the military. So it really does not have the effect that was intended when President Clinton signed that. And he'd be the first one to say now that it was a mistake and he should have just eliminated any restrictions on people being ready to serve. Anyway, that's that story. Christine O'Donnell's story continues to amaze. She is, as of the last poll, is something like 20 points behind her Democratic opponent. Richard Bloomberg was the candidate in Connecticut who is the Democrat who lied several times during his political career saying he had fought in Vietnam when he had, in fact, served in the military during the Vietnam era but had never been to Vietnam. We reported on that story a long time ago and described his behavior as disgraceful, and it clearly was. When you compare the choices, Biden has quoted, Joseph Biden, the vice president, has quoted a former Boston mayor, Kevin White, who, when he ran for re-election, said, "Don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative." So when you're talking about Bloomberg, that's a good application of that saying. He is, generally speaking, I think, a good guy. What he did was completely wrong. But you compare him to the alternative, and it's Linda McMahon, who has her wrestlers, when they sign on to be part of the WWE, which is a practical matter, is the only game in town if you want to wrestle professionally, you have to sign a contract that says that if you die as a result of injuries suffered in the process of the wrestling, that WWE is not responsible, not liable, doesn't have to pay your family anything. And if you don't sign that, you don't wrestle professionally as a practical matter. So you have that, plus the fact that, I don't remember the number, but they quoted it the other day on radio, something like 17 of the wrestlers who have wrestled for WWE have died under the age of 50. And wrestling may be, professional wrestling is phony. But the fact is that people do move around. They are, thrown onto the ground. Brain injuries would not be illogical, but and pain and suffering are not hard to believe occur. But they absolve themselves of any responsibility for that, and that doesn't sound like the kind of person that people ought to want in the U.S. Senate. But the fact is that the U.S. Senate will be, and the House more particularly, will look different after January, when they reconvene following the November election. President Obama said today that he anticipates that following the election, it will create more of an opportunity for bipartisanship. Apparently, cigarettes are not the only things that he's smoking. Let's talk about foreclosures for a moment. The foreclosures have been stopped by a number of large banks in all 50 states. Bank of America is one of them. They ordered all foreclosures stopped. And a number of the other banks are doing similar things. The government, the federal government, has said that a complete moratorium on foreclosures might not be a good thing for the housing market and or the economy. And there are, frankly, some logical reasons for that from an economic standpoint. However, what's happened in the foreclosure market is, or the foreclosure situation, is horrible, shameful, and very distressing. Here's what's going on. When there were a lot of loans being done, of course, and after the loan crisis hit, after the housing crisis hit, and everybody realized that the loans that were done without merit and without regard to whether someone had the ability to pay it back, the next thing that happened was that foreclosures were taking place. So what happened was is that a lot of these loan servicers were processing the foreclosures because they were getting paid to do that. And what happened in many cases is they didn't go through all of the processes that they're supposed to go through to protect the interests of the borrower slash homeowner. And the effect of all that is that people were thrown out of their houses long before they should have been. Now, you can talk about the fact that these folks may bear some responsibility for borrowing money they couldn't afford to pay back, paying too much for their houses, and on and on and on. The fact of the matter is that most of those people were really taken advantage of, largely by mortgage brokers and to some extent lenders. So, in fact, there was a story that was out today about a couple of people who were trying to negotiate an agreement with their bank after they'd missed a payment or two, were paying them thousands and thousands of dollars, and the amount of money that they owed kept going up instead of being credited. Now, you're talking about paying, let's say, for example, they say you owe them $80,000, you pay them $10,000, and now you owe them $83,000. It makes no sense. And so this is being investigated now by a group of attorneys general from the various states, which was the same kind of situation that got a lot of the tobacco companies to settle for billions of dollars, some of which has actually gone to good purpose in terms of health education, much of which has been wasted. But they're doing that, and the fact is, because of what happened with the mortgages that were made, I heard one lawyer today say, nobody knows who owns the houses in America, because here's what's happened. And, well, first off, let's talk about what it used to be like. What it used to be like is you wanted to buy a house, so you went to the Bank of Ding Dong. And the Bank of Ding Dong, they did take credit applications. I mean, we're not talking about going back to the 1920s where, you know, you walked in and Fred shook your hand and said hi and said your name. But even more recently, you would go ahead and apply for a loan to buy your house. You would sign all the paperwork. You'd fill out all the paperwork and sign it, bring it into the bank. They'd have somebody check your credit. They'd make the loan, and then you'd be making the payment to the banks. Okay, good. Sometimes you didn't make the payment to the bank for long because the loan servicing was done by an outside company. So, okay, still fine. But the owner of the loan was the bank or a subsequent buyer of that loan. Still no problem. But here's what happened beginning in the 1980s. Now, many of you already know this. But here's what happened is somebody came along and bought a package of loans from the Bank of Ding Dong and the Bank of Mace and the Bank of Shmamerica. All right, they bought all these loans. They put them into a package, and let's say you're talking about $3 million worth of loans. They then sold shares in these loans, a portion of the package. So, again, as an example, let's say they bought $3 million worth of loans. They might break these up into shares, excuse me, each of which were worth $1,000. I don't feel comfortable doing the math, but let's say, for example, that might have been more than $3,000. Let's say that was $30,000 or $300,000 different pieces that were sold to people all over the place. Now, who owns those loans? More specifically, who owns your loan? Well, the fact is you may have however many people I said, 300,000 or 30,000 people, each of whom owns a piece of your loan and a piece of my loan and a piece of our neighbor's loan. And you have all those people owning a piece of it. So who makes those decisions? Well, clearly it's someone who's in the position of a loan servicer or someone who's in the position of an overseer for these things. And what happens is nobody knows who owns the loan. So how do you find out what, in fact, is really owed? Well, that's part of the problem. To be fair, the people who have been servicing these foreclosures don't know. And so they did the thing that they thought they were supposed to do, or they didn't do the thing they thought they were supposed to do. They just made up numbers. And the entire housing entire housing stock of this country was going along fine as long as people were in their homes, the values were going up, and they were paying off their loan payments, because it didn't really matter at that point who owned the loans. As long as all the payments were being credited, all the interest was being credited, everything was going smoothly, that's fine. The reason that this crisis, which has been brewing for 30 years with regard to the securitization, that's what it's called, of these loans, when people sell off pieces of loan packages, the reason it never came up is because everything was going okay. Well, when things stopped going okay a few years ago, and then these people who were servicing the foreclosures for the banks, for the lenders, or the people who now owned these loans or pieces of them, they weren't necessarily going through all of the processes and steps that are required by law to do during the foreclosure proceeding. So people were thrown out of their houses before they should have been. People were spending money that wasn't credited. It is a crisis of major proportions, and the same thing may be happening in the commercial mortgage industry. So it's going to be something that's going to really depress things for a while in the housing market, but more to the point, even if it doesn't do that, it's really going to be a mess that may be impossible to untangle. So that's what the situation is with that. Excuse me. We had mentioned the Cablevision Fox thing. We have some more news of the weird and this day and this week in history, but I think there's a possibility we may have somebody on the phone here, so let's see what we can do. And let's try that again. There we go. Is this John?
Yes, it is.
Hi, John. That's right. It's the famous John Maxwell.
Oh, thank you. I wish it were true.
Say again, please.
I wish that were true. I wish I were famous.
Okay, well, this will help the process. Jonathan Maxwell, I should tell everybody, is a writer, and he has written and had published by American Book Publishing a book called Murderous Intellectuals, German Elites, and the Nazi SS. And that was released last year, and it has done pretty well in terms of sales along with reviews, and you can get it. You can look up in the search on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com, in both cases, of course. Look up Jonathan Maxwell, or you can look up Murderous Intellectuals. Either way, you'll get to the book. So let's start by having you tell us, if you would, what the book is about and what prompted you to research it and write it.
Well, generally, the book examines why so many well-educated professionals joined the Nazi SS. That was the group that spearheaded the Holocaust. They were the ones that operated the concentration and the death camps. I think a lot of people today have misconceptions about Nazism. They tend to believe that the average Nazi was a lower class thug who lived outside the mainstream of mainstream life. He was an individual of very low achievement, basically a street brawler, a thug, and a hooligan. And to a considerable extent, that gives you a good idea about what the Nazis were, but nevertheless, especially in regards to Nazi elites, many of these individuals were in fact highly educated and they had very respectable backgrounds.
Let me ask you, the image that you described of that lower class thug, that was in fact reality. I'm assuming you're not denying that, but you're saying there was also another group that were the real people who were the, if you will, the cream of the crop, the people who were leading the organization, the
sure,
SS,
supposedly the cream of the crop, yes.
Yeah.
So, okay. I've always had an interest in the Holocaust. When I was in high school, I actually started reading books about the Holocaust. I read a lot of great books, about the subject. As I researched, I found that there was a shortage of information in at least one key area. Many, perhaps even most of the Nazis were thugs and hooligans and street brawlers. But
sure.
Then again, there were some individuals who were not like that. Again, they were career, people. They weren't criminals, at least until, the Third Reich was established.
Anyway.
Yes. Yeah, so, the truth is actually, much more disturbing. And if you don't mind, I'd like to describe, some of these individuals. There were two Nazi scientists who actually won Nobel Prizes. One was Johann Stark, and the other one was Philipp Lenard. These were, brilliant scientists, at least when it came to physics. They actually won, Nobel Prizes, but, you know, at the same time, I mean, they were fanatically supportive of Hitler. They weren't just bystanders. They took leading roles in eliminating liberal professors from German universities. And they also sent many of these liberal professors to the concentration camps, where many of them outright perished. There was a death squad commander out in the Ukraine. His name was Otto Ohlendorf, a very brutal individual. He and his men, over a period of 6 months, they actually shot down about 100,000 Jews. You know, again, obviously, we're talking about a dangerous fanatic, but he was also, you know, superbly educated. He had doctorates both in law and economics. And when it came to Nazi leaders, he wasn't all that particularly exceptional. For some reason, the Nazi Party was full of architects. Ohlendorf had a close colleague, Paul Blobel. Over a two-day weekend, he and his men in Ukraine shot down about 35,000 Jews. This is over a two-day period. You know, that's just absolutely mind-boggling.
And, let me ask you a question. That weekend you're referring to in the Ukraine, am I correct in assuming that that was toward the beginning of the Nazi regime? Do you know what year that was in? Off the top of your head, I understand you researched it.
That was in late 1941. It was right after the invasion of the Soviet Union had begun. And these death squads operated by Ohlendorf and Blobel, they were the precursor to the death camps. What the death squad commanders, what they quickly found out was that you can't cover up bloodbaths like that.
Right.
You know, there's no way that you could keep that a secret. So eventually what the Nazi leaders decided to do was to create something unprecedented in life, the death factory, where people were quietly shipped to these camps. They were, in very secretive areas, you know, usually, you know, way out in, you know, deep forest. And incidentally, the individuals who came up with the idea of the death factories, they actually met at it was a meeting called the Von See Conference. This was where it was decided that, you know, death camps, you know, or something like them were to come into play. About half of the individuals at the Von See Conference actually possessed doctorates. And the Nazi SS as a whole was a very elitist organization. 33% of their officers had college degrees. This was at a time when maybe 1 to 2% of the European population had any sort of college training. So, you know, the truth is even more disturbing than the myth.
Let me ask you a question here, Jonathan. The because we had kind of slid over it, and I want to make sure we cover this for folks who may not be aware. Tell what the Nazi SS is, as opposed to just the broader Nazi party or Nazi group. What was different about the SS? What did they do?
The Nazi SS was the most fanatical, the most extreme wing of the Nazis. Many Nazis were actually individuals who weren't all that different from you and I. They may have carried a card saying they were Nazis, but, you know, basically they were apolitical individuals. This doesn't really excuse them completely for what was going on in Germany at that time. But, you know, many Nazis, they were apolitical. A lot of them, it was just peer pressure. They felt the need to join the Nazi Party. Otherwise, you know, they were afraid that the Gestapo might single them out for some reason. But
yeah,
I just
want to share with you that when you said they're members of the Nazi Party, they weren't that different from you and me. Maybe in some ways that's true, but I can guarantee you they would have never let me carry a card. But go on.
Oh, sure, sure, absolutely. But, you know, you have to keep in mind that many of these people were just absolutely blinded with fear. And,
sure.
You know, the ones who really ran the operation, I mean, they did rule by fear. But,
yeah.
You know, we're talking about the extreme here.
Sure.
The SS was composed of members who, you know, they bought the entire ideology hook,
right.
Line, and sinker. They felt that the Jews and other groups of so-called subhumans like the Poles and Russians and the Slavs, they believed that they were subhuman. They believed them to be evil, and they were absolutely convinced that they had a sacred, God-given destiny to eliminate these peoples off the earth. So
right.
We're talking about the people who they came up with the ideas for the camps or mm-hmm. or the death squads, you know, how they operated, who could be inducted into the organization. So, you know, again, we're talking about an extreme group of people who, you know, really ran the ideology.
Right, I understand. Let me ask you a question because I want to cover this, and I know it's an interest of yours. I want to cover it before we run out of time. But obviously, anti-Semitism was running rampant in Europe at the time the Nazis were first coming into power. And, of course, that exacerbated it. I will share something as a side note real quickly with you about Poland. But before that, I should say after I share that with you, I'd like to talk to you about the modern anti-Semitism and or racism and how you see what's happening in the country today as related to that. But first, I wanted to share with you that I am old enough that when I was in high school, one of my teachers was a concentration camp survivor.
Sure.
One of the things she had lived in a number of countries in Europe during the pre-World War II and, you know, post-World War II period. And she said that as bad as things were in Germany and in Hungary and the Ukraine, by the way, as bad as all those places were, the worst place to be Jewish in Europe was Poland. She said there was worse anti-Semitism, worse violence in Poland. And not talking about the camps, but in the country at large, than anywhere else in Europe. And that was, frankly, kind of a surprise to me. Since then, I've read more.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Even after the invasion of Poland by the Germans, many Poles actually assisted the SS
yeah.
in, you know, rounding up Jews and in killing them. And, you know, they knew full well that the Nazis also viewed Poles as being, you know, inferior.
Right.
And they knew that, but still they hated Jews with such an intensity that they
mm-hmm.
actually aided their enemy. And,
yeah.
You know, it's a lot of people don't know this, but anti-Semitism for centuries had been a European problem, not just a German one.
Uh-huh.
France actually had the reputation for being more anti-Semitic in the early 1900s than Germany. In fact, when Hitler ascended to power, many Jews actually went to France to escape the Nazis, but they encountered so much persecution in France. Some of them were beaten, you know, their property attacked, damaged. Some of them could not find work. There were even cases of prolonged hunger. So, you know, some of these Jews who had recently immigrated to France, they actually went back to Germany because
yeah.
they were more hopeful that, you know, that Germany would improve. And by the time the Jews in Germany, you know, really, you know, learned that Germany was just going to get much, much worse. It was basically too late for them to do much of anything about it. This
sure.
was in 1938, I suppose. But, you know, even the United States, you know, during that time, you know, there was much anti-Semitism here. In fact, there were ships full of German Jews
right.
who wanted to, you know, immigrate to America. But the United States didn't want them, so the ships went back to Germany. And most of the people on these ships actually died in concentration camps. So it wasn't
right.
just a German problem.
Right. That was the subject of the novel Ship of Fools.
Sure.
That some people have either read or seen the movie. And also, I, you know, having read a fair amount on the subject as well, not as extensively as you have, of course, but the way the story is told is that Roosevelt wanted to be of assistance to the Jewish European refugees, but felt he couldn't because if he did, there was such broad anti-Semitism in this country that it would turn sentiment against the American war effort, which I find appalling, but, you know,
skillful
a politician as he was probably right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there was a lot of racial hatred in America. You know,
so unlike today.
Sure. You know, there was hatred for Jews, and there was hatred
yeah.
for blacks, and there was actually, you know, of course, there was hatred for the Native Americans. You know, Hitler actually enjoyed reading Westerns, because it was essentially about white Europeans coming over to a new world and, you know, deporting the native peoples, you know, to reservations
yeah.
and occasional acts of mass murder, because he
right.
felt like that, you know, that's the way history should be. The white European should always be on top, and if that meant, you know, mass murder of so-called subhumans, so be it.
Yeah, I don't imagine Zane Grey probably solicited a blurb from Adolf Hitler, but anything is possible, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Except for the timing. Talk to us a bit about the modern parallels you see, if any, in terms of what's happening in the United States in terms of politics, in terms of racism
well,
and anti-Semitism.
Unfortunately, I see a lot of parallels between some members of the Tea Party, not all of them,
mm-hmm.
but some members of the Tea Party, I think that they've actually adopted fascist tactics to get their own views across. You know, it's very, very funny, but, you know, some of these organizers will, you know, they'll be carrying these signs comparing, you know, Barack Obama with Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. Now, you know, this is just, it's either severe paranoia or it's just, you know, hyperbole. I mean, how do you make a connection between, you know, Barack Obama to someone like, you know, Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler?
Or Hitler.
Sure. And, you know, to a considerable degree, it looks, you know, many people can't understand it, but actually, you know, there's a mentality at work there. One of the most effective tactics of the Nazis, of Hitler and his supporters,
mm-hmm.
was to, you know, demonize an opponent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't return an argument with a counter argument. You know, don't turn it into any sort of intellectual debate where, you know, all the ideas, you know, they have potential, but, you know, we just want to, you know, discuss it and find out which idea is better. You know,
right.
it was entirely personal. You know,
uh-huh.
when the Nazis discovered an opponent, you know, they immediately sought to demonize them. And so,
uh-huh.
you know, the Jews became, members of, I don't know, just pure evil, you know, sent here from,
right.
you know, hell and from Satan. And, It's that sort of tactic there. Just demonize your opponent and repeat that as often as you can, constantly.
Right.
And, every once in a while, just because of the endless repetition, many people, particularly the less informed, they start to believe it. And
no,
so
that's absolutely true.
Sure. So even though, there's no way that you could connect Barack Obama with Adolf Hitler, there are quite a number of Americans who actually believe it. And it's not because, they've thought about it extensively. Just the propaganda has been so relentless that, they start to believe it. And it's very strange because in Mein Kampf, Hitler's memoir, he actually said that, the bigger the lie, the more people will believe it. And that's
right.
What's going on in today's, political climate.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And the weird thing, the only way you can talk about, first off, they're talking about Obama being a socialist, and then they're comparing him to Hitler, which makes zero sense if you anybody who understands anything about the political spectrum. But besides
sure.
that, when you talk to people and they say, the way he's doing things is like a socialist, I can virtually guarantee you that if you ask that person, how do you define socialist, you will never get a solid answer.
And they would have no idea of the distinction between socialism, which is often, democratic, and communism, which is, a totalitarian, ideology.
Right.
Socialism, that's how most of the nations in Western Europe operate.
Yeah.
Great Britain is a democratically socialist nation, as is France, Scandinavia, today's Germany, whatever. And there are no concentration camps. The citizens there have constitutional rights.
Right.
And, to tell you the truth, actually I think we could learn some things from the from the socialists in Europe now.
The whole reason why they're talking about him being a socialist is obviously the thing you said before, to demonize him. It's just
sure.
we
know. It's not an intellectual argument.
Yeah, and the reality is, 15, 20 years ago, what they would have said is not socialist. They would have called him a communist. But now you can't
sure.
call him a communist because there are no communists left. The closest thing you come to communism anymore is Albania. Cuba is not pure communist, although it's probably the purest. China certainly is not. China has a very mixed economy. And, in fact, what you were mentioning about Western Europe is a mixed situation. Yes, it's democratic socialist, but there's also but nothing is pure. And
sure, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, you have a very broad capitalistic means of doing things, and where it is socialist, it's where perhaps there is some sense to that. For example, the railroads, the medical care, health care. But at the same time, while the railroads are socialized in most of Western Europe, the airlines are not. Okay?
Sure.
They're private.
Yeah.
There are exceptions where there's government-owned, but for the most part, they are private enterprise. So it's a very mixed situation there. And we have a mixed economy, too, but it's not all that deeply analyzed. But when you're talking about Obama being a socialist, there are a couple – every time you talk to – and I have talked to some of them – every time you talk to some of these nutcases, which is what we used to call people who talk like that. We didn't talk
sure.
about them being members of the Tea Party or, our conservative brethren or anything. That's what you talked about is that they were nuts. They were nuts then, they're nuts now. The only problem is these nuts may end up in office. But
yes, absolutely.
Every time you ask them to go one level deeper, they change the subject. And I'll give you two examples, one of which I already did, which is you're talking about Obama being a socialist. What's a socialist? You will never get an answer. They will evade it. They'll go around it. If you ask them again, they'll say, come on, everybody knows what a socialist is. Okay, fine. The
sure.
other one is, if you if you talk to them about things they're against, and you ask them to define the thing they're against, they can't do it. A perfect example of that is very nice lady, but she is a very conservative lady who was on our show about a month ago. I've had her on twice, nice lady, excuse me, but she's bought into this, and
many people have.
Yeah, I know, and she was talking about being against cap and trade. So I said, what's your understanding of what cap and trade is? And she may have known the definition, but she certainly wouldn't tell me. Now, I think I know what it is, and it's not important that we define it tonight because we're not talking about cap and trade. But the point I'm making is that when you ask these folks to define what they're talking about, they can't do it. They absolutely can't. And you sound like you may have had some debating experience. As you know, one of the things you do in a debate in terms of framing the issues is define your terms.
Sure.
Well,
sure. And I find it interesting when you confront people like that. Even if you try to come across as being, understanding and open-minded, these individuals, in response to your questions, they tend to attack you personally.
Sure.
Because,
that's how
it tends to work. Yeah, to her credit, yes. But with a lot of these Tea Party members, they'll start attacking you personally because, that's what's happened in our culture now. Don't try to examine the issues objectively. Just, attack your opponent.
Attack. Yeah. Well,
sure. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's the tactic. That's one of the part of the tactic package you were talking about.
Sure. And, the young people, it's almost they've gotten brainwashed by all of this. They watch Fox News or something like that, and, they have this idea that because Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, has his own, have their own shows and they come on the air, with suit and ties, that they must be, credible journalists and not, entertainers. And so, the young people of the day, they find all of it, they find it all normal. If you want to, call your opponent, horrible names, horrible labels, go ahead because, all is fair.
Yeah. And in fact, it has changed the nature, not just the type, but it's changed the very nature of all kinds of discourse and discussion.
Sure.
Because you can't really have a logical discussion pretty much anymore. It's all basically, I'm going to express my view and you're going to attack me.
Sure. Yeah. And it shows you how ill-informed these individuals are, because if you take a look at the facts, now, a lot of these Tea Party folks, they don't do that, but if you examine the facts of the matter, the Barack Obama administration is actually shaping up to be, at least moderately conservative. He's actually continuing many of Bush's policies. During the campaign, he campaigned as a moderate, and he said that he would not immediately pull out troops from Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right.
He wants to take a moderate approach. So, for now, the troops are staying put. And, after a while, he'll, bring in some troops, withdraw some troops, but, he's indicated time and time again that, there's always going to be some sort of U.S. presence in those nations. And, as far as the stimulus money, the conservatives are really attacking him for that, but it's not true. It was actually Bush that began, initiating the stimulus plans.
He's the one who started TARP.
Sure.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And took care of the bailouts with regard to AIG and many other things. Yeah, no question
sure.
about it. And frankly, that was one of the best things that George Bush did. and because it was absolutely essential that it be done, or we would have had a disaster of unprecedented proportions on our hands.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have been as bad as the Great Depression, but it would have been very, very close.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, we're beginning to see now that the stimulus plans were actually, you know, pretty good ideas on both Bush's and Obama's, parts, because, you know, the companies such as the automakers are actually starting to pay the government back for the loans, with interest. So, you know, in retrospect, it's emerging.
I'm sorry, Jonathan, we only have a few minutes. Let me ask you real quick, though. What part of the opposition to Obama, getting back to the theme of your book, do you think has to do with racist views at bottom?
Well, I tell you, I'm absolutely convinced that, for starters, we're dealing with very, very ill-informed people. You know, it makes sense that a lot of these Tea Party members, they're not particularly well-educated. I would say that most of them, you know, they don't have a college degree. Generally, I think they have maybe lower middle-class backgrounds. I'm not saying that in a derogatory manner, but, we're talking about some regular individuals who have become victims of, people with agendas who don't particularly care,
right.
How their, ideas are spread. And, unfortunately, these people, unfortunately, they've had tendencies to, be alienated from groups that are different from them, such as,
yep.
blacks or Jews. So you're seeing quite a lot of that now. And, today's conservatives, they try to talk a good game. They insist that none of their opposition to Barack Obama has
right.
been race-related. I just don't believe it. Because, we're just talking about a very, very irrational hatred for Barack Obama. And a lot of it, is hyperbole. There has been rumors spread that Barack Obama is a Muslim. He said time and time again that he's not a Muslim. And, furthermore, I think that's a private matter to tell you the truth. They
uh-huh.
spread rumors that he's not a true American citizen and that his presidency
yeah.
is illegitimate. That's
yeah.
been shown to be... fallacious, too. Sarah Palin, all right, we're talking about a national politician here. Sarah Palin actually spread the rumor that he was creating death panels.
Death panels, right.
Which is just, pure paranoia. There's absolutely, none of this is based in fact. This
yeah.
was the type of stuff that the Nazis were engaged in, who are almost,
right.
who are also, vehemently racist and anti-Semitic.
Right. Yeah, agreed. Anyway, we're out of time for our discussion, but I want to go ahead and mention again the name of the book and where available. It is Murderous Intellectuals, German Elite and the Nazi SS, published in 2009 and available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. By the way, is this in the bookstores or just on the websites? Do you know?
It's in independent bookstores as well as Barnes & Noble.
That's great. Okay, and the author's name again is Jonathan Maxwell. He's been our guest and a very good one. Thank you. It's been very interesting and really
Thanks
appreciate you joining
me.
Us. I know you're busy. My great pleasure. Thank you. And take care, and I would offer to have you on again, but of course, as you may have heard earlier, this is the second to the last show in the series. So thank you again. It's been great, and I hope that you've enjoyed the process.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jonathan. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we still have a few minutes, so I want to go on and finish, because we did take Jonathan a little early. That's why we let him go a little early, so that we could go ahead and touch base with the rest of you on the other things we're going to cover. However, in the 5 minutes, I'm not going to invite any more phone calls because I want to cover some of the other things, news of the weird in this day in history. So let me go ahead and go through that. In terms of News of the Weird, which you can get at newsoftheweird.blogspot.com, it turns out that 72,000 of the checks that went to Social Security recipients in the amount of $250 each that were designed to speed spending and help the economy last year, in 2009, right, didn't have quite the intended effect, according to the Social Security Administration, because they went to dead people. And as we all know, they tend to spend a smaller portion of their income than the rest of us. We talked earlier about Mississippi, and they are in the news of the weird as well as the regular news. A judge down in Mississippi recently placed a lawyer in jail on charges of contempt of court. That, frankly, happens with some frequency, but this was for an unusual charge. The lawyer declined to put his hand over his heart and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And I'm sure there are some people who may still be listening who think the judge should throw away the key. One more story, and then we'll talk about this day and week in history. Shikeo Taguda is a 71-year-old Japanese man who recently became an actor. He's now a movie star who's made 350 films in a very short period of time because the kind of films he's in don't require a lot of time to make. As you guessed, he's a porn star. He was discovered by a producer that said Mr. Taguda impressed him immediately as having the face of a pervert. And my own thought is that you know if you thought that your career choices were limited at past a certain age, they apparently are not. This day in history, October 14th, Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier for the first time. And I'm betting that you'll guess the year wrong. Or I shouldn't say that, actually. I guess the year wrong. The right year, October 14th, was 1947. This next one's a little easier, especially if you're old enough to have lived through it. The Cuban Missile Crisis began on October 14th. President Kennedy said when it was in process, that was the week they earned their salaries. The year was 1962. And also on this date, October 14th, Teddy Roosevelt was shot by a man attempting to impose term limits. That was 1912. And also on this date, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize. President Johnson, of course, wasn't pleased. That was in 1964. The week in history includes the following. Tomorrow's date, October 15th, Mata Hari was put to death for spying. Guess the year? 1917. And on October 13th, a movie premiered that starred Jimmy Stewart and an invisible six-foot rabbit named Harvey. The year was 1950. Almost everybody's seen that movie, I expect, but generally most of us have seen it on TV. Also, on October 13th, Italy declared war on Germany. It was 1943, and they had to. In a brief period here, I'm going to mention that that was the situation where the Allies defeated Italy, and Germany was still at war with us. And because we had effectively invaded Italy, they were now fighting on our side to the extent they were fighting at all. And they declared war on Germany, as said, it was 1943. I don't believe they ever declared war on Japan. Speaking of Italy, on October 12th, in another year, an Italian sailor with a terrible sense of direction, thinking he'd reached East Asia, landed in the Bahamas instead, and thus discovered America. If you ever wondered why he left Spain in 1492, I would remind you that that was also the year of the Spanish Inquisition. And many historians have argued that Columbus was part Jewish. And yes, they really did have Jews in Italy, and have for decades after. I don't know if they still, or centuries after. I don't know if they still do. But if that story is true, a convenient time to get out of Italy. We spoke earlier of the Nobel Prize. On October 12th, it was awarded to somebody else, Al Gore. And it was for the book An Inconvenient Truth. That was 3 years ago, 2007. That's about it. We have about a minute remaining. We invite you to listen to our prior shows in archive edition while we're still doing the show. I'm going to download them, hopefully, during the next week. And you can join us next week live, and your calls will be invited. We do have a guest scheduled who is an assistant or associate with a naturopathic doctor who is going to talk about, among other things, breast examinations not involving mammograms. So join us, if you will, next week, October 21st, for our final show in the series. Until then, have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Same bat time, same bat station. Have a great week. Bye-bye.